Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast. I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Altered, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime. And my second feature is written and in the works. It's happening.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features and is currently in pre-production on her third. My third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and I used to work at Sundance. This week we welcome buddy to the show and client, writer and director, Zoe Eisenberg, to talk about her solo directorial debut film, Chaperone, and how she pulled the movie together. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Alric, how are you?
Doing good. I submitted my script to the Austin Film Festival on Friday.
Nice.
Which was cool. But then I immediately got my first feedback like a day later. And I was like, oh God, I should have just waited and done the late deadline and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, whatever. It is what it is. It's fine. And then I got my other notes like right after. I got two sets of notes back. And the other one was like, wasn't exactly opposite of the first person, but they were like, basically like, oh yeah, like this wasn't a problem for me. Like the first 30 pages read super well. I loved it. It was, I breezed through it. Here are my thoughts and my questions. And the other one was like, oh, it took me a while to get into it. The first 30 pages were tough, but then once I was in it, I loved it. And I raced to the end, you know? And it was interesting just hearing those two different perspectives, you know, that like one person didn't have any problem. But I mean, to fairness, one knows me really well, has read multiple of my projects and worked on my feature. Other person doesn't know me at all, listens to the show, wonderful person, filmmaker, you know, so I feel like maybe that's a valid, you know, perspective to be like, oh, well, maybe the reason why he liked it so much was because he knows me and he knows my writing style. And so it's like, that's why it was easy to get into it. And for her, it's like, oh, she's never read anything that I've done before. It's like completely new. You know, maybe that was a little harder. Although I wouldn't really compare this movie as the same type of style as to The Alternate at all. It's like completely different. So I don't know. Anyways.
I don't trust positive notes when they come back to me. I go, that's, what is that? Like, I don't, that's just a compliment to fill the void of like the meat that you need to hear back from the person, right?
So you like getting notes where it's like only the negatives and nothing nice is said?
I just want top line. I don't want them to go into it. I don't want them to validate the note. I just want them to say, this didn't work, this didn't work, and this didn't work. And then it's like, they don't spend too much of their time on it. I get what I need from the interaction. We're done. I want
all you
want to
know is if it doesn't work, that's it.
If something doesn't work for them. Yeah. Because I think if they start explaining why, then it becomes like, we've talked about this before, it becomes like how they would direct it, you know? And it's like, ultimately, I just want to hear what confuses you. And then I can fix that on my end.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, then in that case, I don't really have a lot. That's not true. There were some really good notes. There were some really good ideas. There's lots of things I want to work on. It just, it becomes one of those things with me where like I get these notes, I look at them and I sit down to, you know, execute them. And then I start disagreeing with all of them and being like,
well,
no,
listen
I was
to
right.
that.
No,
that's good to listen
right.
to. Yeah.
No, I was right. I was right.
That's good. Then you know, you put your own writing to the test. That's important.
But partly it's also because I'm, part of it was, is also personal because some of the notes I got back from the one writer was like, oh, you know, I really, you should do some bolding here and more negative space on the page and, you know, whatever. And like, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I went through a process with the alternate where, like, when I was writing it, one of the drafts I did, I went through and I did tons of bolding and, like, you know, every prop got a bold, all this bold, blah, 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 blah. And then I can't remember why, if I shared it with somebody or if I was listening to script notes and something and they were like, yeah, bolding, you don't want too much bolding. If you're going to do it, use it sparingly and for the right thing. And I was like, oh my God, I look like a fool, like a fraudish fool having bolded like my whole script. Oh. And so I unbolded the whole thing and I took it all out and then I made it all like kind of standard. And then that's, I like it better. And then so when someone gives me this note, it's like, yeah, like use the space and give more pauses and bold everything. It's just like, I don't respond to that note.
It's
like,
personal preference, you know? I don't do any of that bolding, but Amy, my co-writer and Best Friends Forever, does. And she, like, the way she does it is like jazz. Like she does it right. It brings me into the script and it's beautiful and it's stylized. But like, I never do that, right? It's just, it's what works for you. It's like when people get upset about referencing specific songs in a script. It's like, who cares whether you reference a specific song or not? It doesn't matter. It's just your personal preference.
Yeah, totally. But then, to her credit, she did give some really good notes about like some things I had done, like with supers, like doing some breaks, some chapter stuff. And you made a good point that like I do it in the beginning and then I really don't really do it at the end.
That's fair.
So I need to go back and make that more consistent. And she was like, oh, do it for every sequence should have its own title. It's like, well, you don't want to overdo it. Like I'm basically trying to copy the Pulp Fiction style where it, like, it's like there's six of them or something, you know? Or like whenever they feel appropriate when they're changing to a completely different storyline or character, you know? So I gotta go back and add some of that stuff in there. But yeah, I just got attacked by children. Sorry for everyone. Suddenly there's singing and noises. No, but I guess the point of what I'm trying to say is like I'm in this point now where I'm like taking notes and executing on them. And I basically just need to talk to these two people on the phone. But trying to find time to like have an hour to talk to them about my script is really hard too. So I don't know. It's really good. It's really positive. But it's just like I have another deadline tomorrow. So I'm like, how much am I going to do between now and tomorrow?
Don't kill yourself. Don't kill yourself. I think that's the headline, right? Like, I think you're going about it the right way, talking to people about the script. But like, this is why I don't read scripts. It's like, you want me to sit and read your script and then you want me to devote more time to sitting and talking with you about it? Like, that's cuckoo crazy to me. These people are so nice, like so generous with their time. And I bet you do the same thing, Ulrich. I bet you're equally generous with your time, you know? So that's like very kind of you. I don't have the heart for that kind of interaction. I just don't. But what am I doing? I ask myself, I'm in the process of interviewing interns because we're going to hire an intern for college credit for this summer to help us with the film. I've gotten a few resumes. Very fun to read cover letters from people who do not know, like, not that they should know at all who I am, but don't even pretend to like flatter me in any way or even like Google anything that I've done. And then just have these like really blanket templatized letters that are like, I love movies, want internship. So I'm interviewing them next week. And then I guess the noteworthy thing that happened to me is I went with my producer to a comedy show on Friday that I went to go see, like to scout talent for our movie. There were two actresses that I've been tracking who were going to perform, and those two actresses didn't show up. And I had invited my producer, a buddy, and then that buddy brought his girlfriend. And we just ended up stuck at this show that was like the friends and family of these adorable podcasters and then us strangers sitting in the middle. So my best intentions were thwarted and I just ended up having to just attempt to enjoy myself in a non-professional capacity for 90 minutes on a Friday night. Yeah.
Wait, I have a follow-up question. Was there an explanation given of why they didn't show up?
No, they didn't even comment on it. And I wrote the venue afterwards, like, because I love this place. It's Dynasty Typewriter. It's the only place I leave the house to go to. And I wrote them and I was like, what happened? And they're like, do you want free tickets to another show? Like, we didn't know. They just kind of like dropped last minute, these two actresses, and didn't show up. So bummer for that.
Now they won't be cast in your movie.
Well, bummer no, they
for them.
No, I mean, I need them more than they need me. Like,
that's
you know.
What you think. You don't know.
I have no idea. That's true. I don't know. But I'm working on it, trying to get out of the house and be productive for the film.
I don't know. Are they like name people? Like, would I know who they are? Or are they like just like small, like up and coming comedian actor type people?
If you are into, like, my friend who follows indie comedy knew who both of them were. But okay. This is not like Tig Notaro fame. Like, this is right. Like, this is nowhere near that kind of name. I'm trying to think of like a comparable name. I can't with you. They're very specific. If you follow indie comedy, you would know them.
I'm like thinking of that woman, Mary. What's her last name?
Mary Holland.
Mary Holland. Yeah.
Like yeah. I would say like level Mary Holland level, probably.
Nice. Yeah. Mary Holland's great. She always pops up and stuff. It's really
I love
fun.
Her.
She pops up.
She was on our list, but we're going for actors who are like a few years younger than she plays. And so my casting director encouraged me, rightfully encouraged, that we have to go younger than that.
Get Mary Holland. That's all I'm trying to say.
I mean, we would love to work with Mary Holland, but you know, we would also love if those listening to us right now would head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. It's how we keep the show going. It honestly is how we keep the show going. Like, we're getting a little bit of money from these really adorable ads that pop up every now and then while you listen to us, but the Patreons really fuel our continuation of the show. Without any more delay, here's my chat with the lovely Zoe Eisenberg. All right, Zoe Eisenberg, writer director of Chaperone, can you give us the elevator pitch?
Liz Manischel, I'm on Making Movies Is Hard. Here I go. Chaperone is a narrative feature film. It is a drama that follows a 29-year-old woman who is feeling really alienated and disconnected by her peers and gets mistaken for a high school student by a high school student and starts a very reckless relationship with him.
How many days did you shoot?
Oh my God, we shot 13 days and it was supposed to be 12 and we had a rain day.
Yeah, I've been there. What was the rough budget that you can speak of?
It was under $500,000. It was like well under $500,000.
Can you give a bottom range for that?
It was over $100,000 and under $500,000.
As your consulting producer, I appreciate your ambiguity. And as a podcast host, I am like, I need more information.
I know.
Yeah.
But it's because we don't have distribution yet. If we had distribution, I would be like dishing this out because I'm all about visibility. But I've been gagged partially by you. No, I'm just kidding. I've been kind of. I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Kind of. All right. Can you talk to us about the origin of the idea?
Yeah. So when I was just before I hit 30, there was a volcanic eruption where I live and I had to leave my home and I was kind of displaced at my dad's for a summer, like living like a college kid again. And I was working out at the gym in the afternoons and this high school kid and I struck up a friendship, just like, you know, using the same equipment. And then one day he invited me to a house party and I realized that he thought I was in high school and he was asking me out. And I was like, no, I'm old. I'm 30. I'm married. I know I'm here when all the high school kids are here, but that's because I don't have a normal grown-up job and this is awkward. And we laughed about it. But then I became really fixated and obsessed thinking about like what kind of woman would have been like, this is a great idea. This is the best idea that I have right now, actually. And I just really wanted to know what that woman's life was like, that this would have seemed like a great idea to her. So I invented that woman.
I didn't know that. That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. So you came up with this idea when, and then, so we're trying to build the timeline. Yeah. So what time is that? And then what are some landmarks along the way?
Yeah. So idea conception was summer of 2018. And then I started writing it towards the end of the year and through on and off through 2019. And in 2019, I got into a creative development program that was put on by the state of Hawaii, which was really cool. And there I met my producer, Allison Week. And so she was the first one that came onto the project. And then it took us, you know, another 4 years to get it made.
If you could change one thing about the film in any way, it doesn't have to be production. It could be script. It could be distribution. It could be festivals. It could be the paper that you wrote the script on. What would it be?
Just more time. We had 18 locations that we shot in 13 days. And we knew it was really ambitious going into it, but we are really ambitious. And it was pretty brutal, as you can imagine. I mean, everyone, all the cast and everyone was so wonderful and our crew got along. And by the end of it, like we were all still speaking and in love with each other. So that was validating and helpful because I've definitely been on sets where like the time crunch kind of makes everyone fall apart. And that didn't happen. But at the same time, you know, we would have like, you have 20 minutes for this scene, go. And that's just not conducive for creativity.
So the brutality was related to the restriction of time. Did you feel that in terms of the energy and how do you, as director, do you make a decision to try to cheer people up? Do you make a decision to kind of stay in your own bubble and protect the creative? Like how did you pivot knowing you had that burden?
I really relied on my actors. They are wonderful. And Mitzi Akaha, they're all wonderful, but Mitzi Akaha plays Misha. She's in every single scene of the film. And she was actually attached to the project 2 years before we shot it because we had kind of a false start because of COVID. And so we had gone through many script drafts together. I would, you know, ask her opinion about the character and what she thought and kind of redraft and rebuild. Some of the family structure was built around her family. She's half Jewish, half Japanese. So I was trying to be really collaborative with her because I think she's so brilliant. And that's kind of my lens as a director anyways, is through casting, bringing on people that I know are going to just truly contribute to the project and make it better than it is on page. So long way to say that we would get into these days where I'm like, this is a 5-page scene. We have 20 minutes, so we're going to need to make it a 1-page scene. And her and I would just take a minute and be like, here's where we think the meat of the scene is. And everything else, you know, looked pretty on the page, but it maybe is not important. And let's hope that's the case in the edit.
And it was. It worked out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great movie. I'm curious, knowing that she was attached for several years, 2 years before the project went, how did you find her? Was it a global search for an actress? Was it someone that you knew? Like, how specific were you in the outreach process?
The short answer is I found her on Instagram. But the long answer is that she was cast in a friend's project in New York. So we actually have a lot of mutual friends in New York because I moved to Hawaii about 12 years ago from the East Coast. So I have some connections in the film scene there. And I saw her in a friend's music video, I think it was. And then I went onto her website and like watched everything that she'd been in. And she had been in this really beautiful short film that played at Cannes like a few years before that I was in love with. And I just loved looking at her face. I just found her so interesting and I just wanted to watch her. And that's really something that I knew we needed for a chaperone because Misha is in every single scene. So I sent the script to her and she loved it. We were doing broader casting as well. But when I had her read, I was like, I love her. She's it. And Allison, my producer, was like, maybe we keep going, you know. And I was like, fine, just so it looks like we've done it, we'll keep going. But I was like very set on her.
I am also obsessed with faces, so I completely understand that. And I also love to indulge in that like obsession of the actor, right? Like watching everything, getting to know them from that angle.
It's so creepy though, because like by the time I reached out to her, I was like, hello, I've seen everything on the internet that you, and also she has like a long career as a model in Japan. So there's just like pictures of her for the last, you know, 10 years of just like all over it. I'm just like making mood boards of her face and she doesn't know I exist yet, you know? So it's like, here's a mood board for this project. It's all your face. What do you think? You know, I'm like, I'm so creepy.
But if you're an actor, I mean, I would assume that's the dream. You're like,
I want to be
on a mood board someday. Like, that seems really flattering.
Yeah. And I think that it was a compelling script. Again, she's in every single scene. So to have, you know, a director reach out and be like, I find you interesting and here's a script that I want you to champion, I think was flattering for her and not totally creepy.
Of course. Well, let's talk a little bit about that gamble, just because I'm in a situation right now, you know a little bit about it, but we're casting for our feature. And it's that question of, name value, financing, cart before the horse, chicken before the egg. You know, you fell in love with this actress and you stuck to your guns, your proverbial guns, so to speak. I heard that Allison kind of wanted to be strategic and make sure that you guys were looking in every corner.
Yeah.
But did you ever think about, well, we should really reach out to like these 45 actresses in this age range because they might get additional financing in a different way?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is no, because
whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
For other characters, we did, like for Jake's mom, we reached out to some higher folks. But for Misha, just knowing where I was in my career, this was my first feature that I've directed by myself. I didn't have a lot of work for my own voice and vision to speak to myself. We also knew that we didn't have a lot of money. We ended up raising more. We didn't know what we were going to have to support folks. And all of my prior work as a producer, except for one project, has been like backyard, DIY, scrappy, shooting it in my mom's house. And so that was kind of the way that we knew that we were going to get this made, was not bringing on star talent, because we really didn't have the infrastructure to support them, even if we could bring them on.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, because that's something that strikes me about you, is that you've made other features as a producer, but this is your debut as a director. And you made, those are two features, right, that your husband directed? Is that what you co-directed?
Yeah.
You tell me.
I'll tell you. Yeah. So I'm a fiction writer primarily. So when I fell in love with filmmaking, it was because I fell in love with a filmmaker who wanted a script written. I mean, I fell in love with a filmmaker. We were dating. And then he was like, I need a script. And I was like, oh, I'm a writer. I could figure that out. And so I kind of just like became obsessed. You know, that's like going to be the theme of this episode. And then I became obsessed. So I got completely distracted by film. I started writing, and then I started producing to get the things I was writing made. I didn't realize I was producing because I didn't know what a producer did. So I produced a whole feature, and then I was typing up the credits and I was like, Phil, we didn't have a producer. And he was like, you produced it. That's what you're doing right now. And so we did a feature that way where I wrote, produced, and he directed. And then we did another feature that way that was just larger scale. It was called Stoke. It came out in 2019. It was just a little bit of a level up for us. And then during the production, you know, we just were kind of overwhelmed, and we had a lot going on, and I had been so hands-on with story creation, and I loved casting, and I was just like, had my hands in all these pots. And so Phil just invited me in to direct. I think we were on like day three of the project, just because I would be like, here's what I'm thinking. And then he would like relay it to the actors. And then we'd be like, this isn't working. Like, let's just officially bring you on in as co-director. We were a little bit doing like a Coen Brothers thing with that film before that, where we were like, the lines were blurred. And so I didn't, this is a rambling way to say, I didn't prepare to direct that feature because he was directing it. So Chaperone is the first thing that I wrote knowing I would direct it. I developed it just with my own creative vision in mind. So it feels like my first baby.
Mm. And I don't know if we corresponded, but Stoke submitted to the Creative Distribution Fellowship when I was at Sundance, because I remember I screened it. I don't know if we met or we chatted.
We definitely didn't meet. That was just me throwing spaghetti at the walls and trying to be like, maybe I'm not on this rock in the middle of the Pacific by myself. Yeah.
Well, it just kind of sparks a whole slew of questions about what you've learned from producing that you wanted to apply on this project, and how you were viewing the marketplace for indie, lower budget content, and how that influenced how you put this film together. Like, do you feel like there's a continuum of data there?
I think so. I mean, I continuously want to pay people better, and including myself. And I have more of a vision of what sustainability could look like in our industry for all of us. So our budgets keep getting bigger, not so much because we're spending more even on screen, but because I'm trying to pay folks, you know, what they living wages. It's hard. But at the same time, I'm still building my productions the same way I've always built them as someone who didn't go to film school. It was like, all right, what do we have? And so even with Stoke, it was the same thing. What do we have? We have this janky old limo. We have my friend's house. We have these weird masks. We have an active volcano that happens to be going off while we're in production. So maybe we should write that into the story. And so I did the same thing with Chaperone, even though I'm like, we had 18 locations. It was nuts. Almost all of those locations are like owned by my friends. You know, they have a gelato shop. My husband runs an independent theater. We have access to this place. So I'm still kind of just using the same model of use what you have and trying to upscale, if that makes sense.
It does. And do you feel like with this foray as a solo directorial debut that you've found a certain level of creative satisfaction? Has it, comparing it to the previous experiences, can you talk about how you felt about being at the helm?
Yeah, I think I'm learning to trust my creative instincts. When you're first learning to do something, it can be, at least for me, it can be really hard to be like, no, you got this. When I'm like, do I got this? I've never done this before. I've literally never done this before. I don't have the assumption that my idea is going to be the best idea, you know? So it's kind of learning to lean into my collaborative resources. I know I've talked to you before about how relieved I was to hear that you're not a super technical savvy director, because I'm also not, and my husband is. So when we would work together, you know, he went to film school. He's a cinematographer in his own right, and he understands lighting, and he understands all of that. And I don't. So that was part of our codependency and our creative relationship. And it was also part of what terrified me about trying to go off on my own, because I was like, you don't know how to do anything but tell a story, but you don't actually know this medium at all. And so understanding that I could just bring in collaborators, like bring in, you know, a camera team, bring in a production designer that I really trusted to be really upfront and honest of like, hey, I'm trying to do the best thing, but I'm learning. And do you believe in me enough to learn with me or to teach me? And I feel like I'm rambling at this point.
No, there's a great quote from Nicole Hollis-Center that made me feel really great. And it was that she was admitting there were so many things that she didn't know in this interview with Ted Hope. And she said she would go up to actors and say, you know, an actor would be like, why did you write this line? And she was like, well, I write intuitively and I don't really know why, but let's just figure it out. And some actors responded well to that and some actors really didn't. Did you find that your vulnerability, how do people respond to your vulnerability? Or did you gather a team that specifically would respond well to that vulnerability?
Yes, I specifically gathered a team that would respond well. When hiring, I'm very upfront about that, even with actors. Like one of the larger actors we brought on was Kanoa Gu, who plays Misha's brother. And something that we can get into is like how important casting Hawaii is to me. can get into that later, but you know, when I'm looking at like, okay, who could play this role? He needs to be, you know, this age dynamic. He needs to be half Asian, part Asian, mixed Asian. He needs to have ties to Hawaii. And there's just like, you know, so I found Kanoa and I loved his work. He wasn't necessarily the type that I had written on the page. He was very different than the character I had written, but I managed to get that script to him, to get him on a Zoom call. And I was just very upfront, like, hey, I don't have a lot of work to show you. That's my solo directorial. I can send you Stoke, but my husband and I, you know, we had a very different collaborative voice. It was a lot more like playful and surrealist than my work alone. So I really don't have that much to show you. I have this tiny little short film I shot for actually no money, $0 during the pandemic. And other than that, I just really promise that I'm going to do the best that I can not to embarrass either of us. And we just had this like really, really honest Zoom call about that. And he was like, I'm on board. He's like, I trust you. I love the script. I love that it's a different character for me than what I'm normal. Because he's a very fine man. He's very attractive and he gets a lot of like heartthrobby roles. And he doesn't, you know, he's like, I've never been cast as this like kind of free spirited artist, just like doing my thing. And I'm really excited about it. So anyway, the point is, yes, very vulnerable. And that's just kind of the only real way I know how to be as a creative is just, that's it.
Did anyone respond poorly to it? I'm just curious.
Our sound guy was a lot more experienced and he was also just, you know, he's in his 50s and the rest of us are like 30s and under. He didn't respond terribly. He was just like the most experienced person on our set. And then during our wrap party, he got up and he did this amazing stand-up set about film production because he's surprised. I had no idea. He's like an aspiring stand-up comedian. So he did this stand-up set, just specifically all jokes about film. And one of them was like, how do you know it's a first-time director? They say, what do you think?
Rude. I mean, funny, but kind of rude.
And it was also true because I was always like, production designer, what do you think? You know, my cam op is a great editor, you know, and his name is also Cam. So I was like, Cam, you're an editor. What do you think? Is this going to cut? And so that's just the way that I was and that I don't have any insecurity about that because I think that the people who believed in me understood why I was doing it.
I mean, not to give your sound designer too hard a time, but I actually think that's the mark of a very confident, collaborative veteran filmmaker because you're not worried about your ego being bruised by saying very out loud that you want other opinions. You know, you're going to make the decision. It's
exactly.
Not like they're making the decision. You're just asking for input. Whatever, sound guy. No, actually, he sounds pretty cool too.
He was cool. Like, he was totally on board. And he's also a director. So, you know, because we're all that way. We're all like, oh, I'm a grip, but also I'm a director. You know what
I mean? So it's like, and I get that he was teasing you. I'm just teasing him too.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get to Casting Hawaii, but I think what I want to go back in time. I want to know why you moved to Hawaii in the first place, if you could get into that.
Yeah. So my whole maternal side is here. And my grandmother was military and retired out here. And so then I would spend summers as a kid in Waikiki visiting her. She had an apartment like right along the Alawai. And then, but one by one, everyone on that side, my uncle would be like, I'm going to go visit mom. And then be like, well, this is better. And so everyone did it. Like my brother got into UH and moved out here when he was 18, never came back. My mom moved here pretty much as soon as I graduated high school. She was like, cool, first time snowboarding and then snowbirding, you know, she would do winters and then she moved here full time. And so I was maybe 2 years out of college, in love with this filmmaker. I was working in magazine editorial and writing fiction. He was working in post. He worked for Deluxe post-production. He had a really cool job where he would screen movies for like all of these big people and get to like meet all these people when they would come in and all his like heroes. But at the same time, he wasn't doing anything creative. So he's like, I'm 2 years out of film school. All of my friends who didn't go into post are making their films. I haven't made a film. I need a script. I need time. I need space. We're stuck in a rat race. What's happening? You know? So my mom had this house in Hawaii that she had just bought and she wasn't going to move into for 6 months. She was like, I'm looking for renters. And she just casually mentioned that to me. She's like, for 6 months until I move in. And I was getting ready to move in with Phillips in Brooklyn. And I was like, how about we move to Hawaii for 6 months? Phil, I'll write you a script. You can shoot the script at my mom's house. We'll write it just based at my mom's house. Then we can spend 6 months editing it. And then we'll come back to New York and like figure it out again. And that was 12 years ago. And we are never coming back to New York. We found it easier isn't the right word because it certainly hasn't been easier, but there was a lot less noise to kind of locate the film community here, figure out how we could support the film community here. We started and ran for 6 years a film festival that was just showcasing films shot in Hawaii called the Made in Hawaii Film Festival. And I just think the film community here is growing and thriving. It's small comparatively, but it was a lot easier to kind of find it and then contribute to it than it was in New York, where I think there's just a lot more static.
How do you make a living in film in Hawaii?
So we did the film for 6 months. We kickstarted it. So that's how we paid for it. I was still working for the same magazine that I was working for. And I, for the first 6 years out here, I was doing that. So I was on an East Coast salary living in the middle of the jungle. That's how I supported myself. And then Phillips, after that 6 months period of like trying to edit the film, he started working for film festivals. So he was a technical director or a projectionist, or he was doing print traffic. So he was actually on the circuit where he would be like, I'm gone for 3 months. I'm working. I mean, he worked Chicago, he worked Palm Springs. He worked the Hawaii International Film Festival every year, but he was just kind of doing this like nomadic thing. And that worked pretty well for our relationship at first too, because we're both like, we really value our personal space and time. So he'd be like, bye, babe, I'll see you in 2 months. And I'd be like, woo, 2 months of, you know, my own schedule, my own time, and do whatever I want. And he'd come back. But after maybe 5 years of that, I was like, what's happening here? And then the eruption happened in 2018. Again, that like really shifted a lot for us, because it really, it was, you know, it was our home being threatened, our community being uprooted. He was not home for it. He was off at a job. I think it was Palm Springs, but he might correct me. And I was like, I need you to come home because we have to evacuate. And I need you to tell me what you want. I need you to tell me what you need. And he's like, I can't come home because if I lose this job now, they won't hire me back for next year. And like, this is like, you know, and so I got it. Like, I totally understood. And I'm the type of partner, I was like, heard, okay, I'll figure this out by myself. But then afterward, I was like, we got to figure something else out. If we're going to be here, then I need you to be here. So he ended up stopping the seasonal film festival work. And he got a job at our local independent theater, first as an operations director. And now he's the executive director. So the point is, yeah, so that it took a lot of work and like a lot of figuring out how to do it. But it was also really community based, because the only reason we knew about that job opening was because I was producing circus shows at that theater. And their executive director was like, I'm leaving. And we need, you know, they don't post those jobs anywhere. It's like word of mouth. So it has been really validating how much like what we've put into the community and how much we love this community has kind of come back to support us on the other end.
Well, tell us how that led to your casting decisions on this film.
Yeah. So the first film we shot here, which was called Thruple, we didn't know anyone here. I have been visiting Hawaii my whole life, but I, you know, that's completely different than like actually living in a community. So we did the first film wrong. We didn't know anyone here. So we imported all of our cast and crew from New York because I didn't know what else to do. And the cast, you know, was a primarily white cast. It didn't reflect the community here. I mean, we wrote it so that they were all transplanted and none of them were from here. So we just did that kind of thing. But after that, when I started to become more involved in the community, just as a creative and just a community member, and I'm like, okay, I'm living in a community that is, you know, 70% Asian American, Hapa, Indigenous. I'm listening to their frustrations with people coming in and doing pretty much exactly what I did, which is like, oh, this is pretty. There would be a cool story here. And they're really wanting to either tell their own stories or have stories told that have people who look like them, who represent them. And also they're looking for stories that are just like about regular old people who happen to be from Hawaii and happen to look the same way that they do. Because there's also a lot of, you know, what I call like cultural accessorizing that happens out here, where you're like, it's going to be a Hawaii story and it's going to be about the, you know, this experience. And they're like, yes, those are important. Those should absolutely be told, not by me, you know, a white diasporic Jewish woman from Connecticut, but they also want, you know, stories like Chaperone about, you know, a young woman who doesn't have her shit figured out. And also she happens to be half Japanese, you know.
Yeah,
does that make, that was a ramble. Does that make sense?
It was not a ramble. It made a lot of sense. I was listening. And so I was like, I wasn't even thinking of my next question. Okay. Well, this is a big one. So the film got into slam dance. We have to talk all about the slam dance.
Holy shit. It got into slam dance. And it was so shocking. Because again, it's like, I'm so used to doing DIY. Like when I say everything by myself, I mean, with my team by myself. I don't mean like me by myself. Like we're very like underdog, like lone wolf kind of like, just kickstarting, asking our friends for money, you know, asking family, you know, that's how all our stuff has been made. So even though we have done some cool international festivals with our other projects, and we always get a lot of support from the Hawaii International Film Festival, which is a fantastic festival. So we're lucky that it's like our home festival. I've never had any kind of like larger support for my own projects. The projects that I produce, yes, like I produced a really wonderful short film for Aaron Lau that had support from Tribeca and Netflix and Goldhouse. So like, but my own work as a director, never. So even when we submitted a pretty much a rough cut to Slamdance and Sundance. And I was like, well, that's just the move that you make. Like, you know, you shoot your shot, like nothing's going to happen. And my producer is Allison, is such an optimist and I'm such a pessimist. So we're like the funniest little seesaw where she's like, we're going to be in Park City, Zoe. And I'm like, yeah, okay. I'm going to be not in Park City. I'm going to be at home. You know, that's not going to happen, but I love that you believe in it. And so when I got the call from Slamdance like on a Sunday afternoon. It's the afternoon, for insider knowledge, like Sundance and Slamdance make their decisions like around Thanksgiving. So between Thanksgiving and that weekend afterwards. So I got the call on like a Sunday. I've never been called for someone to tell me I've got anything. It's always like an email at best. And so I was just so confused. I really wish that they could record. I mean, Hawaii, you only need one party to decide you can record things. So I'm like, you guys should have recorded me being an idiot and being like, wait, what? I think when they called to be like, hey, this is so-and-so from Slamdance. How are you? And I was like, how are you? Because I was just like so confused as to why they were calling me. And so we got in. It was wonderful. But like I said, rough cut. We didn't have a finalized sound design. Our color wasn't finished. We'd essentially run out of money. And we were just like kind of in a holding period. And so I called Allison right after they called me. And we had maybe 30 seconds of like, holy shit, holy shit. She was actually on production somewhere else. She's like whispering on set, like, oh my God. And then we were like, they need the film in, I think, 3 weeks. We have 3 weeks now to raise money, get a sound design finished. Like we had a sound designer on board, but it was just like, we don't have the money to pay you. So it's kind of like tinkering in the background. So, yeah.
Wait, amazing. So then how did you do that? How did you pitch your investors? How did you make that happen?
So basically having the key in the lock of a big festival like Slamdance made a lot of people believe in us. That believed in us already, they did, but now seeing that there was like a direct avenue. So we actually got the budget to finish the film all through donations from organizations that supported us. And it was shocking to me. I basically emailed. So like I said, Allison and I met in a state-run creative lab called Creative Lab Hawaii. It's run by our division of like economic and tourism. They're basically trying to put money into the creative industry to help incubate local talent. It's wonderful. It's really supportive what they're trying to do. So I actually took the film through two different labs with them over like the 5 years that I was there. And again, Allison and I met in that lab. So we're very much like a poster child of that lab. And then we also have a wonderful nonprofit called Hawaii Women in Filmmaking that I'm super involved in that supports women and non-binary folks making films here. And then we have this fantastic short film lab called Ohina Film Showcase that is supported by Nella Media Group, a media company. And so they help incubate local talent. So I've had a short film made them. So I just emailed all these people and I was like, hey, we got in. We don't have the money to finish or go because, you know, we can talk about that, how expensive it is to actually go and how much you need to be there. And I was like, we have basically 1 week to raise these final funds so that we can pay the vendors we need to pay to get this stuff done. And they were just like, okay, we have a budget for PR. So we can't necessarily support distribution costs, but we could support PR. So that's a publicist. That's also flying you guys out there. And so all of these organizations kind of looked at their budgets and like what they actually had that they could allow for us. It was just so heartwarming to see them really rally because they know, I mean, they know that it's like rising tide lifts all boats. So to have this tiny backyard film from Hawaii with, you know, a fully Hawaii focused cast and crew, all of our crews from Hawaii going to Park City, it's going to be great for all of us. And so, it was pretty heartwarming to see them pull out all the stops to make sure that we were supported.
And when you're, so, I mean, getting into SLAM.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
It opens doors in terms of, I mean, fundraising, in terms of the optics of your success, in terms of your relationship with your investors. When you were going through the festival, and we haven't even mentioned the award you won, can you talk a little bit about the emotional experience of you feeling, did you feel like you had leveled up? Like, was it apparent to you? Is that exist? Do these tears actually exist? Are they a myth? Like, tell me a little bit about the emotional experience of being there.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I do feel like the tears exist. And yes, I do feel like I had leveled up, because all of a sudden, again, it's like a key and a lock. People that would pay no attention were like, I'm like, but and Slam Dance. And they're like, oh, Slam Dance. And then again, only in the film industry, outside the film industry, they're like, what's a Slam Dance? Or they just hear Sundance. And then they're like, Zoe's going to Sundance. And I was like, almost. So yes, it did feel like we had leveled up. And then we hired a publicist, which I've never done before. I've done it for a book before, so I believe in publicists. I know that they work, but I've never had the budget for one or the reason for one. So we hired a publicist, Millennial PR. They were fantastic. So they helped us kind of like get a little bit of buzz, which you also hear about, like, oh, the film just goes and then they get buzz. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but here we go. And there are many differences between Slam Dance and Sundance, but one of them is that I learned is like the way people are watching films. And Sundance is very much, you have the pass holders and they get to buy all the tickets before they go on sale. So me, an idiot, like I have friends who are like, I have a short in Sundance. I'm like, I'm going. And the day that the tickets go on sale, I try to like, as a muggle, buy them. And they're like, oh, these sold out days ago to pass holders. So that's how Sundance works. And then you have to get on a, like a standby list and like hope that you as like a person without a pass can get in. Slam Dance is the exact opposite, where most of the people who are seeing films are pass holders, but pass like filmmakers, but pass holders don't buy individual tickets. They just show up. So for most of the Slam Dance screening, it looks, if you were to like ask the organizers, how many tickets have we sold? They're like four. Because, and that doesn't mean no one's coming to your screening. It means that all the filmmakers are planning on showing up, because it really is like a very, it's a festival by filmmakers for filmmakers. So that's, and it's, and they've moved to a new location where it's like, or it's their original location they've returned to, where it's like one big hotel with different conference rooms that are screening rooms and like a bar you can hang out in, a beautiful lobby and a coffee shop. So it's just like mobbed with filmmakers in one place who are just like, oh, it's three. Are you going to a 3 o'clock screening? Yes, I am. So that's what I was expecting. But then our screening sold out in advance, which again, doesn't happen for Slam Dance, to the point that the festival director was like, I don't know what's going on, but you sold out your like first screening. And like, that doesn't include pass holders. So like, this is great. I don't know what you're doing, but like, good job. Keep it up. We're so excited. So that buzz happened for us. And we were going to a lot of Sundance events also, because Sundance has this really great spotlight on Asian American and indigenous storytelling. And so a lot of our community is involved in that. So even though we were there for Slam Dance, they have like a whole house just for like Asian and indigenous content creators. So we were like at that house all the time because of the Hawaii connection, and people were like talking about Chaperone in Sundance. So we kind of like felt like we like infiltrated and invaded. And then we also did this really cool, I suggest for anyone, like grassroots marketing thing where our whole team, we had 15 people from our team at Slam Dance. So that's the other thing. But we made these beanies because our the main Misha and Chaperone wears this beanie all the time, which is confusing for people because they're like, why is she wearing a beanie in Hawaii? But Hilo, where it's set, is like Seattle. It's like, it's rainy all the time and we get cold. So anyway, we had these beanies that say chaperone on it, right? And so everywhere that we were going, people were like, what's a chaperone? What is chaperone? Why are you rolling deep with like 14 maroon beanies that say chaperone? So we would be like starting conversations on the bus and in lines about the film. And we were just like able to get people interested that way. And so people were talking about it, which was great. So we sold out our first screening and our second screening was well attended. And then, yeah, we won the grand jury award for our category, which was a shock. It just, I think it was the perfect festival for the film because they are so much about the underdog. And I've always like identified so heavily as an underdog. I still do. So, yeah.
Just speaking to the chaperone beanies, I don't think that would work for every other film title.
No, it wouldn't.
You know, it's like the fact that your film is called Chaperone and there's like a hat is like, this is interesting and provocative enough that I want to know more, right?
Yeah, they were like, what is a chaperone? Who are you chaperoning? Yeah, if I was just like, you know, my great movie title on the they would not have worked.
It wouldn't work. It's, was that part of the whole strategy from the day one was for the beanies?
I mean, with the beanies, I was like, if I saw someone wearing a beanie that just said chaperone, I'd be like, who are you chaperoning? Yeah. And that's what happened,
Okay, well... So you have the dream experience, I think. You have kind of this, like, you make the movie you want to make on the terms that, on your own terms, you get into a high-profile film festival. Tell us a little bit about where you are now. What's the future? How are you building that audience outside of film festivals, and what's next?
Yeah. You know, at the festival, we had a lot of people being like, your phone's going to be ringing. You know, that's the thing they like to say. And they were actually literally saying that to me. And my phone has not been ringing. We'll just say that, which I kind of anticipated. Like, I knew that this was going to happen.
Being the underdog that you are. Yes.
Yes. I was like, I'm going to go home to the jungle and it's going to be like crickets, you know, afterward. I mean, not for everyone. Like, our lead actor, we've hardly talked about him, but who plays Jake, the 18-year-old kid. He's fantastic also. And he, you know, went with us and got a bunch of calls and a new manager and went out to LA, and he's moving to LA at the end of this week from his experience in Park City. Wow. So stuff is happening, but for me, not as much, which is the way it is. So we're out to distributors. We're getting, you know, passes as is normal. Hopefully we will get some offers. We have gotten some offers, but they're not quite a fit. I mean, you know, I'm just telling you, you're the one doing this. But, you know, and we're still pretty early in the process because we submitted with basically a rough cut. So now we're submitting to all the other festivals, and we've gotten into a few already because of the buzz. The buzz helps. We have a Rotten Tomato. We're 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, we've got the good stuff to be like, hey, we did this and we did that and we did this. But it's still at its core a tiny, low budget film with an entirely Asian American cast and Indigenous cast. You know,
it's a drama.
It's a drama. It's a drama, right? If, you know, so it still has all of those challenges. So even with like the best possible footing it could get, which is like the Slam Dance premiere and the award, we're still, you know, we're still out here. Like, hello, watch my movie.
What I think is noteworthy, and I hope it's okay for me to say this, and we can cut it out if you want, is that from my vantage point as a producer's rep, seeing the companies that actively reached out to you versus me being on other titles and having to chase those people down. Like, I was actually chasing the same people down that sent you emails, like, like very, you know, enthusiastically. I think that is reflective of the quality of storytelling you've made and the buzz that you've done. It's like you've done absolutely everything you could, in my eyes, to give yourself the best launching pad possible. And I think, if I may say this, this situation you're in is like the microcosm of the state of distribution. It's that like really fantastic, well-decorated films are going to get attention, and they're gonna, your film will be known and people will screen it, but the question is, will it be a commercial success, right? I think that's the question mark here.
Yeah.
Do you feel one way or the other about that?
I mean, I do in terms of relationships with my investors, because they want to make more movies with me. But first they want, like they've said that, but first they want to see how this does, right? Yeah. So I want it to be a success for them. For me personally, it feels like a success already. And we can talk so much more about like the development of the script and how hard I had to fight for a lot of the choices that I made, that people specifically, you know, when we're looking for money, this is a very... this is a woman's story, and women were connecting with the script tenfold and men were not. And at first I was like, well, this is a film for women, so I'm probably just going to stop taking notes from men. But all of the investors that I knew were men. And so it was really hard. And that's part of why it took so long. And luckily, we did find one female financier who's fantastic, but we also found our lead EP, Adam Wong, who is fantastic and was just like, yeah, this is a woman's story and that's important. And I might not fully understand like all of the narrative components, but I see that this has an audience and I can't wait to support it. So like one of the good ones, you know, and we had another, Gil Holland, same thing, very experienced producers, but the same thing where he was like, I get what you're doing with this story, even if I'm not the target audience for it. And so then to have this film be finished and be getting really fantastic audience response, that is honestly what's the most unexpected, because I was like, all right, we have a publicist, he's going to get reviews, but like you have no control over what those reviews are going to be. And again, being a pessimist, I'm like, cool, everyone's going to hate the film, that's what I'm used to, and everyone's going to keep telling me what a shitty person the protagonist is, because she does, she makes really problematic choices and I find them very human and very relatable. But a lot of people on the page were like, what a demon, we hate her. And so to have the opposite experience, like if you read our Letterboxd reviews, which are just like random people who went to the screening, they're great. And that has been the most surprising thing for me. But again, I think it points to what you're saying, where like people are enjoying this film, but that doesn't mean it's going to be a financial success.
Well, there's just such a gap between the gatekeepers and the people watching movies. Like that's what I'm seeing. And mm-hmm. It's so fantastic that you again, I hate the expression stuck to your guns. If there's another, stuck to your principles. There we go.
Yeah.
That you stuck to your principles. You made the movie that you believed in, that you wanted to see, even with your pessimism. I'm a pessimist as well. I think that's obvious. But but even like hedging your bets that you may not be well liked or people may not respond to you, I think you made the true artist decision to stick to your principles. And mm-hmm. I think you were rewarded for that. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. that's beautiful. But again, like that's what your film is such an interesting case study, because I can totally see that people would not respond well on the page. And I can totally see gatekeepers calling the characters problematic. But who cares, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's how I hope that the takeaway is who cares, and yeah. that and that you made really high quality art and that we'll still find a way to make your money back.
Yeah.
But that some of the responses are, again, just reflective of a really broken system.
I agree. And like even the ability to stick to my guns was learned, right? Because the film I made with when I co-directed it, I was also getting feedback. There was no love story in that film. And people really wanted these two, this was Stoke. They wanted a romantic connection between these two characters in it that I was like, this isn't part of the story. This isn't what the journey of the character is. But like everyone that read the script was like, these two characters need to, so I rewrote it and we shot it and I like wrote a whole, I reworked the whole story to support this like love thing that happens. And then when the film was finished, we were like, this doesn't fit at all. And we removed it. We struck the whole thing. And then when that film comes out, everyone's like, I love that there's no romantic element in this film at all. I love that. I love that about this film. And so to go through, as you know, it's expensive and time consuming and whatever to like shoot all this stuff that we didn't need, that I knew the whole time we didn't need, just really made me be like, nah, I'm good.
Follow your instincts. Follow your instincts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think it's our time. I think it's time for our final six questions.
Right.
Putting you on the spot. What's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now? You could interpret that in any way.
Yeah, the first film I ever made was a feature because I am a psychopath. And it is called Thruple. It is currently, I haven't watched it in 8 years. So we can say that about how I feel about it now. I mean, I think that it was a beautiful thing that I made with beautiful people, literally and figuratively beautiful people. They're all has the most gorgeous cast ever. It got distribution because of its title, thruple. And that was like, I thought when I wrote, it was like 2011. And I was like, I made this word up. And now it's like very zeitgeist. So it did get distribution, but I don't know where the film is. Like, I don't know where you can watch it. It's in distribution hell. So that's how I feel about that film.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Use what you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Make a love story. No. Worst filmmaking advice I have ever received. God, I don't even know. Aim higher. And I know that that seems like controversial, but even like there was a while where people were like, no, you should be making like a $2 million film because that is whatever. That's the budget. Yeah. And I'm like, that's going to tank me. I cannot make a $2 million film. So I think that just goes back to use what you have.
Use what you have. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Make more stories. I do focus on pretty much female-driven stories, queer-driven stories, or indigenous-driven stories. Those are the voices that I really want to be supporting, two of which are my own, female and queer. And then the indigenous is just, you know, what I think that I can give back to my community where I live and the voices that I want to be supporting. So I guess my goal as a filmmaker is just to make more space for those stories.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice you'd give yourself?
Be very intentional about your collaborators. I think when I was first starting, it was very much like, who can help me? Who wants to do this, right? And I had to learn over time that, you know, you really have to be choosy about who you bring into your space.
Yeah, that's good advice. Is making movies hard?
It's the hardest, man. It's the hardest, man. It's the hardest. It's the hardest. It's really hard. But especially like as a fiction writer, because we didn't talk about that at all. But like I have a novel that's also out this month that I should plug. It's called Significant Others, and you can buy it wherever books are sold. But the point is that writing a novel is so much easier than making a movie. It is not easy. It is still hard, but it is so much easier than making a movie. So as someone who works in multiple creative mediums, I can say full-hearted that making movies is really hard.
Thank you for being on the show. Yes, plug. So you plugged your book, plug yourself as a filmmaker. Where can people go to support you?
Yeah, I have a website. It is zoeeisenberg.com. I am on Instagram, although I had to remove it from my phone because I am so addicted to it. But you can find me at Zoe Eisenberg, posting about fiction and film and circus. You can find my book, Significant Others, wherever books are sold. And yeah, Chaperone should hopefully be finding a distribution home this year. It'll be coming to other festivals this year. So just, yeah, we're on Instagram too, Chaperone Film Hawaii. So you can hopefully find me in all the places.
All right, Auric, what's the one thing I'm supposed to tell you about my conversation with Zoe? I guess I just want to gush about her. When we stopped recording, she was like, you didn't ask me about how I listened to Making Movies is Hard and how... like I would lie in my room and listen to the podcast and think about making my movie. And now I've made my movie and I had this full circle moment and now I'm on your podcast. And I was like, no, Zoe, I didn't ask you because I felt really uncomfortable about that. So like now I'm bringing it up now. It's amazing that she listens to us. She's so talented. She's such a good person. I adore her. And apparently Auric, this podcast and you creating this podcast helped her journey quite a lot. So I wanted to mention that to you.
Wow. That means a lot, you know, because we do this show every week. It takes up a good amount of time and energy to do. And I can't imagine ever stopping doing it. But yeah, no, that's really special because, you know, I, the whole point of making this podcast was because there wasn't a podcast that existed that I wanted to listen to where directors are talking about making movies so I could get inspiration to make my first feature. And so the fact that, like, you know, I helped create it and I kept it going and then you joined us, Liz, and then now it's actually helping people make their features is like... is incredible. It's like the whole point of the podcast coming to life.
That's sweet.
It's amazing. So yeah, thank you so much, Zoe, for listening. And I'm really excited to see your feature. And I'm really bummed I missed out on the conversation. But what is also really exciting is that it is time for You're the Expert. This is a segment that our producer Eric Combs invented, where he basically poses questions out to our listeners of, you know, hey, what questions do you have for our expert filmmakers, for Liz and Allwork, who know tons and tons of stuff about filmmaking. So he sources these questions for us. Some come from him, some come from listeners. But here is this week's question that we get to read in advance. So we have prepared answers for this. But here we go. I've just written my first screenplay and I'd like to fundraise and make it into a film. But how do I know this is the right script? The script I wrote is very personal and doesn't fit into a particular genre. But if I'm being honest with myself, my favorite films are more popcorn genre films. Yes, I want to get to my art out into the world, but I want my film to be financially successful so that financiers will fund my second, third, and fourth films. So, yeah, how do you know it's the right script, Liz?
Wow, this is a very tough question because they used like my favorite words that are manipulating me, that it's a very personal film, right? It's a personal script. And I'm like, oh, make that one, make the personal script, make the idea that comes from your heart and it reflects a certain like squishy, I don't know, pervy, weird side of you. Like that's the type of movie I want to see people making. Not that things that are personal have to be pervy, but I'm just saying they always have to be like a little bit strange because personal is interesting and eccentric. But then they said that the movies that they watch are not those movies. It's like, ultimately, you want to make the movie that you want to see out in the world. I think, who are we talking to that said that? It was like a Jordan Peele quote. Nathan Blackwell was like quoting Jordan Peele, like, you make the movie that you want to see. But I think you should make the movie. Wow, I'm like referencing all these interviews we've had recently. Clinton Cornwell was like, you shouldn't be result oriented, right? You should make the movie you want to see, but you shouldn't anticipate like the result of it shouldn't inform why you make it. And also, I would say you cannot guarantee commercial success. Like it's absurd to think that your financiers are going to go back to the well 2, 3, and 4 times. It is a very hard marketplace. Don't presume that in any way. I would still encourage them to make the personal film because that feels important. It feels like it's art that could be of use to someone who might find it relatable. It comes from the heart, and you can't anticipate commercial success. And then the next script you write, make it your popcorn movie if you want, but make it the movie you want to see, not the movie you think is going to make you money, right? Alric, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think that you should take the decision to make a first feature or any movie for that matter lightly. It should be a serious, like, big decision. And if you're like uncertain about your first screenplay and wanting to make it into a movie, then like you need to really, really think about that long and hard, because you need to be really, really devoted to this project because it's going to take so much of your time. Like, you know, people say, oh yeah, 2 years. It's no, it's probably more like 10 years. Because even if you make it in like 6 years, let's say, or 5 years, you still have to, you know, get into film festivals. You have to get it, you know, to distribution, and then you have to promote it, and then you have to live with it out in the world forever. So it's like, you know, you should really be diehard crazy about this movie. So I have a couple of suggestions. I have one would be, take your personal story and make it into a popcorn genre film so that it fits both, because you really, you do want to make things that you want to see in the world. You don't want to make movies for someone other than yourself. That is like total stupidity, craziness, which I've had friends who have done that, you know, and it has not gone well, you know? And so you really, if you're a horror person and you're trying to make like a coming of age drama, because it's a personal story to you, maybe that's not the right movie. Maybe you should be making
it personal. Personal, Ulrich.
But you can make a personal movie that's a horror movie that is also personal, and that you can fit both. Like it should hit all. Yeah. Like I'm actually, that's kind of, I didn't really think about that, but the alternate is both. It's a personal movie to me about my life and my background, and it's a sci-fi horror movie, thriller, you know, it's both. So I think that's the magic, is like finding something that hits all those things. I would say I'm going to give lots of answers here. So the other thing you could do is, if you're like, no, this is the script, it is important, I need to get my art out into the world, blah, blah. Okay, well, you know what's great about first features is like, they're not going to be the greatest most of the time. You're not going to be Quentin Tarantino most of the time, right? Like, you know, even for me, like my first feature is good, but it's not like, it didn't set the world on fire. So there's something to be taken away from like just practicing. So like if you can make this movie for $10,000 to $20,000. Like if it's like a genre, a drama movie that you can shoot, you know, in your hometown with friends and like, you know, do it really small. Maybe do that. Maybe take your movie and just make it for a low amount of money. Raise $10,000, $20,000, something like really reasonable. Or like if you have some savings, just use your savings and make the movie that way. Get it out of your system so then you're ready to make your second feature. Because what I've also learned is a lot of times people don't even really watch your movies. They just see that you've made a feature. So like if you have a feature under your belt, that is probably very helpful to getting your next movie made, even if it's like not necessarily in the same genre as what you want to be making your movies in. But I wouldn't don't make it a huge thing. Like do it for a low amount of money. If you feel like you, basically, if you feel like you have to make it, then do it that way. But I would say probably better to like, yeah, I wrote my first script. That was great. I learned a lot. Now let me write my second script. That's also a personal story, but is also in the genre that I want to make movies in. So that's probably what I would say. That was a good question, Eric. Yeah. Amazing.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Eric.
But yeah, what do you guys think? What would you do in this situation? You can send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@mickeymoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, which is like extremely helpful. Or ratings are great too. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Zoe Eisenberg for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.